you had this very important interview of Tucker Carlson. Two words were so bold in this interview: compromise and cooperation. That Putin, when it came to the relationship between Russia and China, was talking about these two words. Does the West, does the United States know how to compromise?
No. They don't have combined West, and the United States do not have political elites, and they cannot compromise, because basically everything which is done politically in the Western world today, it's all about optics. You cannot look weak, you cannot look not strong, and things of this nature. Then you of course add here this exacerbating factor, the incompetence pretty much of the political elites and people who really run the West. And then when you begin to understand that United States, I mean, you're not talking about Europe. Europe is done as the subject of the international politics. But the United States has this elite producing machine broken. Mostly what you get, you're not getting statesmen. You get primarily people who care only about re-electing or electing themselves into some kind of office and enriching themselves through that. And peddling, their, influence. And as the result, again, do not forget, it was Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower, who in his final speech, on the 6th of January, 1961, he mentioned military-industrial complex. But the reality, of course, was he was talking about military-industrial congressional complex. And as his daughter stated, as his son John stated, why he didn't use the, military-industrial congressional complex, which was in the original text of his speech. He said, I still had a couple of bills in Congress I needed to pass. So, but the reality is, we all know that what Eisenhower meant, and what he described is nothing but the corruption scheme of the basically circulation of the money and influence within this triangle. Well, it's not triangle now; it's rectangle primarily, because throw in the so-called fourth estate. Utterly corrupt legacy media in the West, and especially in the United States, and you get what we get today. So they cannot compromise, and they don't know how.
If you look at the NATO expansion and the results and the consequence of this expansion for Europe, it was devastating. It didn't have anything to benefit Europe. And it seems to me that even when it comes to Europe, the closest ally of the United States in this conflict against Russia and China and other countries, they don't have a compromise even with Europe, and Europe says nothing about it.
Obviously, ancient Rome, for example, which was omnipotent for its time, they preserved and they tried to preserve the, for example, Greek heritage as much as possible. So you see, even Romans, who we obviously view as a kind of, the people of the brutish nature, so to speak, despite obviously many achievements of the Roman Empire, but I mean, they preserved the Greek heritage, Greek philosophy in many respects, and many people say they, many of them worship even the Greek gods. So, but the you don't have this with the United States anymore. As I already stated, most of the United States elite, which is being produced through all those colleges and especially Ivy League, most, not all, but most of them are highly uncultured people. And they brought up within the framework of American exceptionalism, which is completely confabulated concept. United States history is basically confabulated. It is written, it's just pure fantasy, especially its military history. When you look at this, they do not understand what the strength of the United States is. And there are many strengths in the United States and its political system. But what you have this generation of people who really do not value Europe other than, as Dostoevsky stated, and I speak about periodically, that he visited Europe many times. He lived there. And in 19th century, he stated that it's just merely the, very fancy graveyard under the open sky. So, and those people in the United States, they obviously don't see much value in Europe anymore, because it is all about, as I already stated, enriching themselves and, peddling their influence. So for them, Europe is just, some continent which cannot really provide much income, so to speak, or profit for them anymore. This is the type of the so-called political leaders United States system produces now.
Finally gets to the point that says enough is enough. Let's be a powerhouse. Let's be independent. Let's say no to the United States. Do you see this coming to Europe? Because we have some sort of changing in Europe. How do you see it?
No. I mean, and I understand we have obviously the economic upheaval happening right now. It certainly can or may contribute down the road in, who knows, emerging of some kind of European elite. And we see the farmers, and but you have to understand that Europe is far gone now. For example, if you look attentively at Germany, it was completely emasculated. It's the same goes for France again. France cannot actually assert itself nationally anymore, because they say it's about 10-15%. There's a suspicion that there's more than 30% now of the minorities who run in France, or who in France for purely economic reasons and of welfare. They don't care about, Fifth Republic. They don't care about, egalité, fraternité, whatever the hell they love to talk about themselves, in French. So, and when you look at this, and then you suddenly see the situation with that they don't have resources, really, very few resources. I don't know how can they really regain any kind of their whatever the common European identity, which is also a mythology. If you look attentively at Europeans have been really good at killing each other. Okay, let's face it. And so it's a much more complex history than it is presented. And of course, this very popular mythology gains again over Atlantic values and, NATO and European Union. It's all mythology. Primarily, it is all about squeezing money and resources or whatever technological ideas from Europe. And now Europe is a burden. What can you get from them? United States, for whatever is happening in the United States, and United States is in a deep pickle here, or as our good friend Garland Nixon loves to say, in a deep kimchi, So, but at least United States has resources, Europe doesn't. And when you look at them, so hey guys, it was your culture, you voted for that. And many people constantly accuse me that I say, oh, you know what, people are, they have been brainwashed, they have no agency. No, they do. And always I bring the example of Trump. It was American people agency. They elected Trump. And this is it's a very strong argument. Another matter that Trump turned out to be just as most of them are hot air balloon, but other than that, people believed his rhetoric and his program, and they voted for this. These guys there in Europe, they always say, oh, CIA runs this or MI6 or whatever. Well, guess what? There is a, the United States is the home of the CIA, where we don't know what they are doing, despite the fact that constitutionally they are prohibited from conducting any kind of operations within the United States proper. But the point is, compare this. Who would in their normal freaking mind would vote for what is turning to be incorrectly, they call it the European left, but basically it's European uber liberals. As much as we cry about woke culture in United States, but guess what? We have the Bill of Rights here. We have First Amendment. People are pushing back. Do you see anything happening in Europe? And they always find the excuse that, oh, we cannot do this, we cannot do that. But then you look at it and says, and ask the question, what about Hungary? Why? How happened? How did it happen that this relatively small country stands its own ground and elects actually the traditional conservative nationalist government? There you go. And they have been at it for a while now. So in the end, it comes down to what happened to Europe, and Europe gladly and applauding joined in, which is being basically emasculated, completely devoid or denied of the traditional culture. And now they face the, so to speak, face the music. And as the result, this is where we're at right now.
In order to have some sort of compromise between two sides, there should be some sort of balance between them to accept that. Because after the collapse of Soviet Union, it seems everything's gone and they see nobody to stand against them. And they are the sole superpower that can rule the world. This is the way that we have been experiencing all these years after the collapse of Soviet Union. When you look at this decision by Gorbachev, do you find it there are people who are praising his decision to put an end to Soviet Union, but there are many people out there who are criticizing this type of decision that made a big problem for all the countries all around the world.
When we talk about Gorbachev, obviously he wasn't alone. He had a significant support within the party from the nomenclature, much of it already being privileged. It was Gorbachev's surrender of the country, despite the fact that Soviet Union definitely had significant issues, and political system and economic system was not working anymore. But it could have chugged along, for a while, and some incremental reforms could have been implemented. But Gorbachev, being not only a coward, which he was a very cowardly man. He was also a very not very bright man. Okay, and he was supported by the party nomenclature, which wanted and saw Soviet Union, or whatever happened with the after the collapse of the Soviet Union, but whatever, the historic Russia has been admitted to the West, to the combined West, and this was the, so to speak, main idea, main driving force behind Gorbachev basically being incompetent on the international level, believing on the word, and basically looking for praise among the Western military, political and military elite. He was very, very lustful after the praise. Any kind of flattery was very good for him. And when you look around with whom he surrounded himself, it was a bunch of sycophants who also pursued their own, so to speak, political and financial objectives. For example, if you take a look at Mr. Shevardnadze, who was at that time Minister of the Foreign Affairs, and the guy wasn't Soviet or Russian patriot. He was a Georgian nationalist, essentially, and he couldn't give a, flying whatever coitus about the if the Soviet Union disintegrated. He was interested in basically already then having the established his fiefdom in Georgia, and which is today independent state. And so when you look at this, and majority of those people around Gorbachev, they either have been utterly corrupt, or they have been people who to basically truly believed in the fact that Soviet Union at that time could become a part of the West. And that is why they were ready to go and just basically become oblivious, deliberately oblivious and blind to what was happening then. And as the result, well, we have the result, and instead of incremental reforms or going to what many today say it could have been the Chinese model, Gorbachev decided to basically, just open things on a political sense without understanding the actual geostrategic and economic, basically main pillars of the existence of the Soviet Union. And there you go. Once you withdrew the elite, which became essentially treasonous of the Communist Party, that was it, and there you go. We have what we have today. And as the result, obviously, the world socialist system imploded. And then you had this all, the consequences, which as like I believe it was Dmitry Orlov with your podcast who stated that, for example, a Soviet Union helped there, which is absolutely correct, to liberate from colonialism a tremendous amount number of countries, including in obviously in Africa. And then suddenly Soviet Union collapses, it withdraws. Russia is basically exists on the level of bare survival. And guess what? France comes in, they recolonize Africa, and the process kind of goes backwards. And Gorbachev is one of the most hated people in Russia. And it's not just because of the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think so Russians overcame this tragedy, geopolitical tragedy, which, quoting Mr. Putin himself, but what he still hated because Russians recognized if it wasn't bad enough that he committed essentially a treason, but they recognized in him a coward and the person who was basically corrupt in the final analysis.
I was so surprised that Putin, when he started talking about Yeltsin in his interview, he said he knew everything. He understood everything, what was going on in those days. How do you see the role of Putin in the aftermath of the Yeltsin administration?
If you can find it in on YouTube, when Mr. Putin became the president, I mean, pardon me, prime minister of Russian Federation, he became prime minister of Russian Federation from the post of the director of the FSB. Do not forget his background. And he was talking about at the celebration of the KGB FSB, one of their holidays. And you can see him that talking to the whole, I mean, auditorium full of people, the cadre officers of FSB, KGB, and all that, and SVR. And he says in a joking manner that successful insertion of the agent, I mean, so it happened. So, and everybody starts laughing in the audience because everybody understood at that time that Putin wasn't alone. It was what is called the group of siloviki from the world of power. This is military intelligence complex of Russia who understood, and especially after the humiliation of Yugoslavia, of the gang rape of Yugoslavia by NATO in 1999, and Russia essentially selling Yugoslavia out. Albeit, let's put it this way, Serbs, they also have reasons to blame themselves, how they betrayed their own heroes. But this combined was the, so to speak, the last straw which broke the camel's back. And we say that Yeltsin decided to give up power. Who knows? I think so. He was forced, but we will never know it, or we will know it, in generations. When some generations will, basically pass, and then the archives will be open, and it will be told how really it all happened, because obviously, for all intents and purposes, Putin was not that significant in the Yeltsin's power block and governance block, which was dominated by criminal figures of the scale of, for example, Mr. Berezovsky, who was essentially one of the guys who was basically flaming the conflict in Chechnya, and who was behind actually Russia, not military defeat, there was no military defeat, but who played the game totally against the Russian people, totally against a Russian government. And of course, again, who were in government? Look at those people. They were all corrupt criminals. So suddenly the fact that, oh, Yeltsin suddenly understood who Putin was, I don't think so. But again, I'm speculating, but it is speculation based on the solid factors. So especially, so for example, just to give you an example, when Putin became the prime minister, Mr. Berezovsky, who was at that time the, well, what amounts to national security advisor in the United States, analog, he basically asked Putin, who the hell are you? So it wasn't like Yeltsin wasn't a very bright man, to put it politely. Plus, you're absolutely correct. He was an alcoholic. He was the man who had no knack for real statesmanship. And so I think so. These were Siloviki people who still had the control of the army and intelligence services, who asked Mr. Boris Yeltsin to just fade away, you know. And Putin kept the word of not harming the Yeltsin family, which actually committed basically treasonous, implemented treasonous policies in Russia in 1990s, and essentially took part in robbing Russian people. So, and in this case, you have suddenly this former FSB director of the FSB, the guy with the serious intelligence background, and by the way, a very good level lawyer in and of him itself. And he comes in, he brings this team which supports him. And this is not the team of lawyers. This is the team of people who know how to conduct, you know, clandestine operations, how to blow things. And of course, you have also support of the military. And then suddenly things change.
In Iraq war, he said, we were trying to build up relationship with the United States. At the same time, they were helping these separatists, these terrorist groups in Caucasus. You see, these balance of power is just gone. You see, Putin has no power to stand
Do
against
it.
the United States. And he talked about these five waves of NATO expansion after that. You see, five waves of NATO, and Russia can do nothing about it. Just say, no, don't do this. Nobody cares about what Russia is talking about.
Well, it was the red line, and they again, as I stated, America, United States, and I wrote three books on that, and I'm writing the fourth one. It doesn't have the strategic assessment and analysis as such. They write about it. They write all those, you know, white papers and those think tanks, you know, produce that. The problem is you cannot come and, for example, take General Petraeus or, you know, or some, you know, Mr. Burns as the chief of the CIA say, dude, you operate on completely confabulated history. The only reason you were doing what you were doing, not because Russians actually surrendered. They still believed that they won the Cold War. But as Pat Buchanan stated, Russians extended their hand of friendship and it was slapped away. I quote you. And that's the problem with these people because of the lack of culture. They are uncultured people in a larger sense, as I constantly stress. For example, if you understand the difference between whatever, you know, Scotch, you know, brands, or you say that, or you have been to Louvre, it doesn't make you cultural. It makes you more or less refined. But culture is a much more profound thing. And what culture are we talking about in Washington, D.C.? And they basically started to confabulate their history. For example, they still believe now that they won the World War II. It's I did the video. They believed that they won the Cold War. They believed that there were all kinds of things, you know, and they rewrite the history. They bought into own BS. And because of that, they, as I already stated, they cannot do strategic analysis and they cannot do strategy. They don't understand what strategy, especially military strategy, is. You cannot have this understanding when your whole military history is essentially confabulated. You still have those people who refer to this Gulf War. You know, oh, we have been so strong. No, you haven't. That's the problem. You beat them. It's like it's, you know, 20-year-old, you know, master of boxing or MMA fighter beating the 5-year-old kid in the sandbox. But they still refer to it after the, and they still think that it, oh my God, it was something special. It was not. But they create this because obviously the only thing which is they exist is for the optics because it is completely tied to the electoral cycle within the United States, which of course political power translates in money and it translates in those comforts and you know just corruption becomes the modus operandi practically of the whole system. And as the result, they believe that you know Russian patience and Russians' desire to compromise and talk about it, it has been viewed as the weakness. It hasn't been viewed as the, well, in Russian culture, which is the warrior culture, unlike it is American culture. American culture is not warrior culture. It's very militaristic, but the United States doesn't, none of the people in Pentagon has any idea what real war is. They never had, actually. And so when you have the warrior culture of Russia, which formed in the 1,000 years, they do not understand when people offer to compromise at the side is because they know about war, about strategy, much more than the opposite of them, which was the United States. And they think, oh, they want to talk to us. Oh, they're weak. They're nobody. They won. Who cares? We're the greatest, you know. Exceptionalist culture in the United States is a cancer. And finally, it has been exposed. And then they suddenly recognize, oh, we're not that great militarily. You never were, you know, especially when the Soviet Union started to actually basically transfer itself or transition into the third generation warfare. And many things, for example, Soviet Union was already leading. Many people don't know, but on the edge of the 80s, Soviet Navy alone have been basically producing and deploying weapon systems which United States already didn't have. And they were beginning to fall back. For example, if you look at the submarine development, let alone missilery and things of this nature. But you cannot go and explain it to people, primarily lawyers and political scientists who run this politics within the Washington establishment. They have no clue about it. And as the result, they think, oh, okay, we expanded once by breaking the word. We expanded twice, third time, oh, nothing happens. Let's go and, you know, just continue to do this because we are great, we are exceptional. We are, as late Madeleine Albright stated, we are indispensable nation. And then bang, they run into people who did this for 1,000 years. Russian general staff is older than the United States. So they go and they think that they can, you know, defeat people like that. The Russians had enough. And there you go. And suddenly you see everything what actually it used to be, we can say, depending on Russian, from Russian point of view, it all falls into place. From the American point of view, obviously, it's all falls apart, you know. And as I already stated, American elites are not producing statesmen. They produce politicians, and politicians are mostly corrupt ones. So there you go.
Putin said CIA was declaring to the Russian government that they're helping oppositions. It's so amazing when you see how blatant are these kind of activities.
It's the country I do not recognize. I'm not alone. Many millions of Americans do not recognize their country. Because they held, and still many hold, me included, dearest, you know, constitutionalism. One of the greatest achievements in the development of the political systems, especially on the West, is the Bill of Rights. You know, our rights, our liberties, that's what I love this country for. And then you suddenly have this, and my gosh, it's complete corruption. It's rotten from the inside. And being blatant is also sometimes, how to put it, as I already stated, it is also the lack of culture. For example, there was a sort of the guy who was in charge of Russia in 1990s on the American side was Strop Talbot. And he's been described while he was visiting Moscow as being arrogant, speaking with people as if they were below him, and which also explains, for example, that a large part of the American elite is actually racist to the ultimate racism, because, for example, they look at Slavs, at Russians, as the lower racial entities. So it's simple as that. And that is why, but again, they do not understand, the history. They don't understand the drivers of the world history because they originate actually from pretty much, again, confabulated backgrounds of some kind of the attempts at the American aristocracy. But America never had aristocracy. Some of those people, with weird beliefs have been basically kicked out of England, essentially. So, but if you look attentively, there is no aristocracy, there is no the servile class in the United States. It never existed. So they do not understand even the cultural drivers behind the way people view history, for example. And again, it's shocking. For me, I knew it was bad. You see, I wrote three books about how bad it was, okay? But when it's really exposed itself how bad it was, I was shocked. I thought they were not good enough. They not just not good enough. It's a catastrophe. It's the very low quality human political material, which absolutely doesn't understand what they are doing. And obviously, they, again, as I already stated, they had this 90s experience with the post-Soviet Russia. They believed into this Cold War garbage, which have been essentially instilled in them by people with very limited intellectual capability, like William Buckley, you know, and most of those American political thinkers, they are second rate. They do not understand history, let alone none of them, none ever understood what real warfare is. So, and you have these people who have been so obsessed with defeating Soviet Union. That when Soviet Union collapsed, they say, oh my gosh, you see, this is confirmation of our, so to speak, messianic role, the shining city on the hill. And there you go. Everything basically started to go from there. And eventually, yes, as I already stated, they really believed that they defeated Nazism. They really believed that Hitler was defeated by the United States. They do not even understand the numbers, you know, which have been involved in their effort. How it is expressed in the real serious military statistics, you know, economic statistics, because you have people who only know how the Wall Street works. And there you go.
Putin said that let's have a unified missile defense system, United States together with Europe, but Russia is not part of this. Why was that? What was the reason behind this?
Well, because Europeans don't like Russia. Majority of population of Europe, I mean, I don't know how large majority, but majority, I would say, okay, if I ask me number, 60, 65%, they don't like Russians. They don't like Russia. Germany, Germans, for the most part, not all, especially in the Eastern Germany, they don't like Russians because they can never forgive how they've been beaten in the World War II. French don't like Russians because you know what happened. Russians, the same as with Germans, Russia marched, took Berlin twice, Russians took Paris, and people who think that, oh, you can go in and, you know, just retune people, no. When you have those so-called elites, and some of them with a long, long, so to speak, history, German elites, they cannot stand Russians, they hate Russian gods. Because, well, for Germany, each other person in the political elite in Germany has somebody who was a Nazi or Wehrmacht soldier. They probably lost somebody because Russians defeated Hitler. So you have the same with France and in the elites. Europeans don't like Russia. That's the very simple thing. And that is why they have been very happy because they really believe that Soviet Union just sleeps and dreams to go there and, you know, interfere with the gay pride parades in, you know, in Europe. While in reality, of course, Soviet Union didn't want to capture or attack Europe. But they believed it. They wanted to believe it. And guess what? Because of that, you got practically full cooperation on their side with the United States. And plus, they believed they bought this mythology of the, you know, this technology of the United States, the same as the Star Wars, which was a complete wet fantasy, basically, wet dream on the, you know, side of the American military industrial complex and Reaganomics. And as the result, they were willing accomplices. That's what many people do not understand. That's why I'm saying I love European culture. I am a man of European culture myself. But the problem is when they begin to find those excuses, no, 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 guys. You put yourself under the rapist on your own. And you actually applauded doing this. So there you go. And now it's too late. And so they can say whatever they want. But Russians are done with, they have been done with the West practically since 2014, 2015. You know, now it's over. Russians wouldn't even shake hand. You know, if they have something to say, they can come or call, you know. But again, you cannot talk to French elite, you cannot talk to German elite, you cannot talk to any elite in Europe. All corrupt, and they have been always and will remain Russophobic. You cannot change that. And they will never forget how they have been defeated time after time by Russians. There you go. Simple as that.
Missile defense systems. Right now, if you were to compare these two systems, the Western part and Russian part, how do you compare them?
Air defense, Western air defense systems do not even qualify to be the world class. Some of them can perform some functions. They can shoot down, for example, high-flying, slow aircraft. Like, for example, Patriot shut down big transport IL-76 in full civilian capacity, which was flying 65 Ukrainian POWs for exchange. No system in the United States or NATO in general can even touch anything like S-400. They have nothing even remotely comparable to S-500. And in terms of Nudol A-235 and its mobile version S-550, I don't think so they even have concept of how to deal with that. They just have nothing comparable. So, and yeah, they have this GBI thing, you know, to intercept of the, you know, the ballistic targets. All modern Russian air defense and airspace anti systems, they're not just merely anti-ballistic, they are anti-hypersonic weapons. So they are designed to meet the future threat, which whenever it happens, of shooting down even their maneuvering hypersonic gliding blocks. So there you go. West has nothing like this. I mean, not even close. They're not even, I don't know. And that's pretty much explains it. But again, as I already stated, they thought in 1990s Russia was done. They didn't study the real history of the Soviet Union. They did, though, how to put it politely, removed a lot of technical documentation after the Soviet Union collapsed from very many enterprises of the Soviet military industrial complex. And they tried to implement them, didn't work out.
When it comes to the objectives of Russia in this conflict in Ukraine, Putin said they haven't achieved all of their objectives yet because the final step going to be denazification of Ukraine. What's your take on this part of his interview?
In the long run, it's possible, but do not forget, Constitution, as any law, and Constitution is the main law of the land. It has to be supported by what essentially any state has the right for. It's actually the essence of the state, a government existence, the monopoly on the violence. Anybody who comes there and says, oh, yeah, you know what, it's democracy, whatever the garbage they say. No, the government and state, when it formalizes itself, has the sheer monopoly on the violence. That's what violence creates power. Violence obviously could be very different. You know, for example, violence could be just blowing city to smithereens, or violence could be police taking down the criminal. Guess what? Both could be constitutional acts. And when you look at the, for example, police taking down the criminal, that's the law. That's the law which is derived from the constitution of, or basically main law of the land. And in this particular case, obviously, there will be the outlawing of any kind of the Nazi element of the in culture, so socially, what have you. But much of it will be based around first, I think so, that Ukraine won't be a really independent state, whatever will be left of it. It will be obviously supervised by from Moscow. And it will be supervised by a very powerful man who will be in charge of it. Kind of, you know, gray cardinal, if you wish. People even talking about that Ramzan Kadyrov eventually will have to step in and, you know, just clean up the act of those lands. But it will be based on a very strong Basically, the law enforcement agencies, be them counter intelligence or be them just regular police force, which will be able to actually execute their all those items, so to speak, or clauses prescribed in the new constitution, and the way it will be obviously derived from the constitution, the other lower level laws, which delimit the powers of the force, which is law enforcement, and whatever paramilitary will be left there. And in this particular case, they will be conducting their clandestine operations against any kind of the Nazi element, which will be also not limited merely to the, you know what, you know, wedging the finger on them, you know, and saying some bad words. No. Many people will be arrested, they will be prosecuted and persecuted, and that will be the one of the instruments of the denazification. And it's a complex process, and I think so. It's already not the military issue, it's the issue, as I already stated, of the counterintelligence and law enforcement organizations, which will be formed once the Nazi regime in Kyiv is removed.
Do you think that the United States is reaching to the point that say, no, it doesn't work in Ukraine, let's go after the negotiating table, let's find an acceptable compromise?
Well, the reason I'm smiling is because it's actually in the interview to Carlson, and Putin states very clearly, the West cannot defeat Russia on the battlefield. And now the question says, how the West will withdraw from the, it's not going to be negotiations. He talks about the, and actually Tucker also asked him about how can we deal with dignity? And he said, it's completely up to you how you want to save your face. You can do it with dignity, or we will continue to do, and it's what we're doing essentially now. That's what he's saying. You can look it up, you know. And the point is, if they want to avoid Afghanistan on steroids times to the fifth power, that will be dignity. They should come and beg Moscow to somehow arrange it. If not, Moscow doesn't care. Russia is in the complete strategic dominance of the situation, and if need be, Russia has forces and means to go as far as it wants. That is why they're creating this panic right now about that Russia wants to attack, you know, NATO. Such a stupid idea. Why would Russia need a bunch of the freeloaders when Russians never lived as good as they do now, you know? And the point is that, yeah, it's pretty much... Putin stated, and with Tucker asking this question, it could be now only two ways, with dignity or without it. And that's it. There will be no negotiations now. There will be now only negotiations on how far Russia will allow West to go in terms of saving its face. Period. There will be no negotiations that West says we want this and that. No. There will be nothing like this. But Russians can arrange it such a way that, oh, yeah, we talked, you know, and we found something, you know. But the point is, Russia is dictating conditions right now. If they don't like to do it, sure, fine. And, you know, they obviously, again, don't forget, the whole political system and the whole media thing in the West operates on only one premise, to give a good optics. These are incompetent people. They won't be able to run the 7-Eleven store without bankrupting it in 2 weeks. And so in this case, the only thing they understand is that because many of them are sociopaths, they are very cowardly people. So they understand only that the fact that they could be humiliated. And as any sociopath, they are afraid of this. And there you go. That's the weapon Russia holds, you know, to their temple, if you wish. As in military terms, there's nothing to talk about. I mean, West simply is impotent militarily, and there you go. That's what actually predicates the, you know, this whole situation. So Putin answered it very clearly. up to you guys how you want to do it, with dignity or without it, but it's going to happen one way or another. So nobody cares. If they want dignity, let them come and beg, you know, Moscow. And there you go.
The quantity of mercenaries in Ukraine, he said the first country is Poland, the second is the United States, and the third one is Georgia. I never thought that the United States would be the second.
First, let's be very clear. Not all American mercenaries there are mercenaries, okay? Very many of them are cadre officer and cadre soldiers, which operate undercover, or as it's called in Russia, under legend, okay? You have some major with their, you know, graduate of West Point, who suddenly, oh yeah, he basically, you know, retired from the army and he's a free guy now, and he goes and, you know, as the, private citizen fights for Ukraine. No, nobody buys this garbage. I mean, and it's just like, you know, it's for people who still, you know, get the military education from the, you know, Top Gun Maverick. The reality is, of course, there's a bunch of the not only advisors in official capacity, American generals and officers, but bunch of the tactical level guys who have been thrown there to get their, so to speak, experience of how to fight Russians. And of course, many of them didn't like it, because many of them have been killed. Others, I mean, believe me, this is not Afghanistan or Iraq. This is completely different paradigm. And now suddenly they're coming back to the United States and say what actually Ukrainians stated. Guys, take our field manuals and throw them away. They're garbage because they're not designed to fight real war. That's pretty much the message they will get there. And in this particular case, when they say they're mercenaries, some people say, oh, look at how many, you know, the helicopters fall and other people die, and they do it for, you know, to cover up those who are being killed in Ukraine. Possible? Oh, absolutely possible, but I don't care really in terms of how they cover it, or I just know for sure that there are many cadre people there, and they're specifically there to learn. I don't think so they will learn. I mean, they learn how to survive, but I don't think so they will understand how it all works, because they are on the receiving end. And when you are on the receiving end, you're not going to like it. So, but the fact that the American mercenaries are there and they are second in number, yeah, absolutely. And they would ask how many out of those Polish mercenaries actually are cadre officers of the Polish army, and actually many of them, the intelligence officers or assets of NATO countries. So there you go. And so it really makes no difference. In fact, is I was surprised that American contingent, so to speak, hasn't been the number one, you know, ahead of Poland. But Poles evidently have their own scores to settle with Russians. So there you go.
Putin clearly said that Russia is not going to march toward Poland, Latvia, as long as they're not attacking us. Do you think that we are going to have some sort of changing in the mind of Europeans?
You can sell a lot to Europeans. I mean, not all of them, but yeah, Europeans, unlike it is there with the United States, which, by the way, that's a huge cultural difference. In America, there, after especially Carlson's interview, their legacy media are dead. It's over for them. You know, he absolutely destroyed them. He just stomped on them. And you begin to see now Tucker or some wonderful girl like Candace Owens, you know, and other people emerging as the monsters, you know, of the now, which comes now alternative media, which becoming actually mainstream. Tens of millions of Americans tuned of that, if not hundreds of millions, you know. So, and but in Europe, they have this propensity to believe their media. You know, they are more brainwashed than Americans in this respect. And so in this particular case, obviously people who have been already predispositioned to questioning the whole narrative in Europe, they obviously enjoyed this interview, and some who were sitting on the fence maybe already changed, so to speak, their opinion. But I think so it's massively affected people and society in the United States. That is why they were so hysterical in those media. And again, do not forget, in terms of the American media, European media are the pipsqueak. You know, they do as they're told by CIA and their curators. But in reality, American media, when you look attentively at the statistics in the first 24 hours, it was a demolition of the everything combined, including combined with even Super Bowl audience. That tells you something. So, you know, and now we have Margarita Simonyan. They counted in RT and other organizations 1 billion views in 48 hours. This is stunning. This is unprecedented. Nothing ever like this ever happened in the history of journalism. So there you go. And suddenly, who are those people on CNN or MSNBC? They are nobodies. I mean, they are just propaganda, and they have been called as such.
Putin also mentioned his experience with Bill Clinton and George Bush. How powerful is the president of the United States, in your opinion?
Of course, the decline of their power, so to speak, or influence of the U.S. presidents started after Eisenhower. I think so. Nixon was the last one, and he was obviously, you know, what happened with the Watergate. And after that, it was on decline. And after that, there were obviously the totally elites, not elites. You cannot call them even elites. This, so to speak, governing class. And those different vested interests, which were running essentially American political or foreign policy consensus, for example. It was Nixon who could say, oh, okay, no, we still go and do this, you know. And when you listen to what he says, for example, in the his foundation videos, after already he have been unemployed, so to speak, for a while, he talks about the media being absolutely just horrible factor in American political life. And don't forget that media also begin to, they call fourth estate, they are beginning to influence tremendously their foreign relation, not only of the domestic agenda, but foreign policy. And after, so basically the last guy who was more or less capable of putting things together was obviously George Bush Sr., who was, for example, he was a bona fide World War II veteran, you know. He was a man definitely capable of, and he had a pretty strong people in, with him. For example, if you remember Mr. James Baker, the you know, Secretary of the State, he had a top-notch diplomat, Jack Matlock, in Moscow as an ambassador. So you look at those people, they were just serious people. And then you have this guy, playboy, we don't know, you know, from Arkansas, who becomes president, you know, and he brings this all new progressive whatever people, and they view, you know, you've lost Cold War. That's what they think. Go and just be as we're told. But Clinton is now suddenly, when he becomes in terms of foreign policy, who he is, he was, of course, relying upon a huge infrastructure of those vested interests and many people who probably had a dirt on him, you know. So he couldn't just come out and say, okay, yeah, let's do this and go out and convince his administration. I think so. At that time, it was actually other way around. His administration was convincing him what to do and what to say, except, of course, with the you know, the his Clinton scandal with Monica Lewinsky, which largely precipitated on a completely fake, you know, premises attack and gang rape by NATO of Yugoslavia. So, but other than that, after that, I don't see. George W. Bush, W., he was completely not an independent figure. And it was, you know, Even his father already had a significant number of the neocons, such as Dick Cheney, at that time the Secretary of Defense, and they had these people kind of, you know, penetrating to the fabric, so to speak, of American policymaking. And by the time we had George Bush Jr. and 9/11, you have practically completely neocon or what is called neoliberal, or also interventionalists, which is this combination, huge fusion of these two activists, foreign policy activists. And after that, none of them really had any power in sense of formulating of foreign policy. You either have the neocons through his two terms, then you have Obama with the liberal interventionists, which become essentially part of the neocons. And now you have the, you know, what can I say? You know, after Trump, guess what? Trump administration was filled with neocons and Israeli forces. Now, what's the difference? Doesn't matter which president comes, let alone who would, nobody takes Joe Biden seriously in the world. Except, of course, for the Washington establishment media and some nut jobs from the Democratic Party. The guy is a joke, pardon me, you know? And this is the president of the United States. And everybody understands he is not running the country. He is not running day-to-day operations. And he is doing as he told to do by people who are incompetent, uncultured, and who are, well, you know what, basically some of them are downright evil people. So that's your American foreign policy, how it proceeded through the, you know, times of, you know, well, let's put it this way. The first infusion of neocons happened during Reagan administration. This was the guy who brought them in, you know, those, you know, I don't know, you just, it's horrible, you know, what happened. And we have now today, the whole situation is corrupt.
Just to wrap up this session, getting back to the point that we started this talk, two keywords. The first was compromise, the second, cooperation. When Tucker Carlson asked him about these differences between BRICS and G7, he said, it doesn't that important because at the end of the day, these are two parts like human brain, two parts that should work together in order to have a prosperous world. I think this was one of the brightest things that he has said during this interview. This is the future of the world that everybody is looking for, everybody who's seeking peace and prosperity. We know that Russia, together with China, learned how to cooperate, how to compromise. Here comes the United States, which is a very important country. Are we getting to the point that the United States is learning how to compromise with Russia and China because of all these difficulties that they're experiencing right now in Ukraine, in Taiwan?
No, not now. No, not yet. And as I already stated, until the political elite in the United States is removed, it cannot change. You cannot change Victoria Nuland. You cannot change most, just majority of people in Congress, for example. So, but eventually, who knows, there is a so to speak, a little bit of the common sense, normal people beginning to operate in Congress and raising their voices. But this administration, no, you cannot talk to them, and they are incapable of talking. That's what I'm saying. And now you have to keep in mind another thing. Vladimir Putin obviously was talking about the larger geopolitical picture. But do not forget, by different estimates, we have now more than 1 million casualties on the Ukrainian side. Number of tens of thousands of Russian servicemen have been either killed or wounded. Somebody has to answer for that. And we know who are the guilty party. And until this done, there will be obviously no talk about any cooperation or compromise. Because in the end, there are, as was the case with the Nuremberg trials, which basically sealed the fate, at least publicly, of the National Socialism, Nazis. Same has to happen first in Moscow and Donetsk, and Russia is working hard on it. and obviously many people with their English-sounding names from United States and Great Britain and in Europe, they will be named there, and the charges will be leveled at them in crimes against humanities and in war crimes. Until that happens, it's difficult to see how it will go anywhere, because the tribunal will happen. Russia is actively working on formation of it, and people, very big stature people, are involved in this. One of them, for example, is the chief of the investigative committee. So, and after that, we'll see. We have the elections coming in the United States, which might be the elections which will either, well, they will seal the fate of the United States, sort of to speak, one way or another, because the way United States exists today, it cannot continue to exist like that. Economically, it's absolutely being torn apart, and politically, we know what is happening. We also have the generational change, which is horrendous. So if United States preserves itself as the unified state, and we have the new, so to speak, generation, which we can see now of the American le legislators coming through, then yeah, sure. In fact, is in all first, there are only three real superpowers in the world right now. It's United States, China, and Russia. And how they will settle in this triangle is very important. Originally, United States and Russia should have been actually a tremendous couple. Just to give you example, in 19th century, with the development of the railroad transport, one of the guys, I don't remember his name, he saw that Denver will become the center of the one of the major political and economic centers, because he was dreaming about doing the railroad from Denver through Alaska to Russia. And by the way, this project and this idea is not dead. People still working on this, thinking how you can unify the actually railroad systems of Russia and the United States. Can you imagine what this would have brought? The amount, the wealth, and the development of the regions, both for the United States. And again, Denver certainly would have been, just showing, yeah, we're center more important with than Washington, D.C. And so, and just to give you example, United States, sadly, in the face of people who came with the Clinton administration, and as Pat Buchanan said, they slapped away the hand of friendship. Now, something should happen, and then we'll see what happens down the road, you know.
Europeans and the United States were the first in many things. Right now, with the change that we are witnessing in the world, the sense of compromise and cooperation you see in the Middle East, you see in Africa, people are feeling this, the necessity of this. Do you think Europeans, together with Americans, would be the last people to join this manner of thinking?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. They are the, don't forget, they have been at the top for 500 years. And old habits die really, hard. So it's very difficult. And again, especially we have the situation which is so multifaceted. Just we have the destruction of essentially Western education. It is destroyed completely on the level of the public schools and universities, and I mean, it's unbelievable. This devastation visited upon the Western world by the ignorant exceptionalists in America and in Europe, by those globalist elites, it is devastation. It's a cultural, social, and economic. And West first has to recover from that, and then maybe put itself together somehow, and then it may join indeed into what promises to be an incredible development of the human technology, social programs, and things of this nature. So it could be a very bright future. Will we see it? We'll see.